It would be considered somewhat crude today, but we had the whole package. We demonstrated what virtual reality could be as a product. Nobody else had done that. Young Harville. And I think we also touched a place in terms of the cultural dream, where it kind of flourished in people's imagination and literature and movies. So I think we did well. Jaron Lanier. Nobody had put the whole thing together, and nobody had just shown the joy of it before. We showed the joy of it. From insanely great to greatly insane. General Magic mentors a generation. Chances are that you've never heard of General Magic, but in Silicon Valley, the company is the stuff of legend. Magic spun out of Apple in 1990 with much of the original Mac team on board and a bold new product idea, a handheld gadget that they called a personal communicator. Plugged into a telephone jack, it could handle email, dial phone numbers, and even send SMS-like instant messages, complete with emoji and stickers. It had an app store stocked with downloadable games, music, and programs that could do things like check stock prices and track your expenses. It could take photos with an optional camera attachment. There was even a prototype with a touch screen that could make cellular calls and wirelessly surf the then embryonic web. In other words, General Magic pulled the technological equivalent of a working iPhone out of its proverbial hat, a decade before Apple started working on the real thing. Shortly thereafter, General Magic itself vanished. Andy Hertzfeld. The Macintosh had a great launch. It was really successful at first. Steve laid down a challenge at the introduction, which was to sell 50,000 machines in the first 100 days, and it exceeded that. But then starting in the fall, sales started dropping off. Steve Wozniak. It just didn't have any software at first. Fred Davis. Mac Paint and Mac Write were like demo programs. They weren't real tools that you could use to do stuff. Steve Wozniak. The Macintosh wasn't a computer. It was a program to make things move in front of Steve's eyes, the way a real computer would move them, but it didn't have the underpinnings of a general operating system that allocates resources and keeps track of them and things like that. It didn't have the elements of a full computer. It had just enough to make it look like a computer so he could sell it, but it didn't sell well. Andy Hertzfeld. By December of 1984, the forecast was to sell 80,000 Macs, and in fact they sold like 8,000. So something had to be done. If the Mac wasn't going to catch on, Apple didn't have a future. So what to do about it? John Sculley. In 1985, Steve introduced the Macintosh Office, which was a laser printer, the laser writer with PostScript fonts from Adobe, and a Macintosh. One problem. The product just didn't work. It wasn't until a year later that the microprocessors were powerful enough that you could actually do the kind of things we were actually promoting back in 1985. So people weren't buying it. Steve got depressed, and then he turned on me. Andy Hertzfeld. It got to the point where Steve was openly sabotaging Sculley. Something had to be done. Sculley and the board didn't fire him, but removed his responsibility from running the Mac, and so he had to leave. Ralph Guggenheim. Steve left in 1985. There was a rumor that he was starting a new company, Next. The Next machine was Steve's effort to build his vision of a desktop workstation with lots of computing power and a CD-ROM. It was his attempt to show what he could have done at Apple. Steve Perlman. It was big, it was black and white, it was clunky. Andy Hertzfeld. Next was a revenge plot. That's the reason I didn't work at Next. Steve denied it, and we'd argue till he was blue in the face, but it was true. The purpose of Next was to eclipse Apple. And I loved the Mac. I didn't want to work against the Mac. But Steve wanted the Mac to fail. And so he started next. Meanwhile, back at Apple. Larry Tesler. Steve was gone. Where are the new ideas going to come from now that we got rid of Steve? We're going to run out of Xerox's ideas. Where are we going to get ideas from? The management wanted new ideas, and so they decided they needed what they were calling the Advanced Technology Group. It was really an R&D group, a lab. Steve Proman. We were building a color Macintosh. Steve Wozniak. The Mac wasn't ever really selling until we introduced the Macintosh 2 in 87. It had color. Larry Tesler. One of the things that grew out of it was the Apple Fellows Program. The first three Apple Fellows were Steve Wozniak, Bill Atkinson, and Rich Page. The initial definition of a fellow was someone who had made a big impact on the industry. Al Alcorn was recruited. He had done Pong. And they also wanted to recruit Alan Kay. So we brought them both in. Alan Kay. Steve never forgot where his ideas came from. Andy Hertzfeld. Alan Kay was my hero. I was like, damn. But it was still time for me to quit. Larry Tesler. And then as the program expanded, and it even included a person who is not an engineer, Christina Hooper Woolsey. Christina Woolsey. I came in 85 when the HyperCard stuff started. Bill Atkinson spontaneously decided to do the product. He and a small team just popped this thing out. Al Alcorn. HyperCard was developed by Bill and two or three guys in advanced technology. And it wasn't supposed to be released. Products are supposed to be released by product development, not by advanced technology, understand? But Gasse, who succeeded Jobs as head of Macintosh development, wasn't going to have it. So Bill and his team just conspired. And while Jean-Louis Gasse did his French thing and went off for a two-week summer vacation on the beach in the south of France, Bill just released it. And when Gasse got back, he was furious, but he couldn't stop it because HyperCard was really well received. It got great press. There are a lot of stories like that. Andy Hertzfeld. But the beginning of General Magic is really Mark Porat. He's a very clever, non-technical person. An impresario businessman who, in the thesis he did at Stanford, came up with the first use of the term information economy. Mark was a college friend of Larry Tesler's, so that was his connection to Apple. And he was hired on in the fall of 1988 to work in the Advanced Technology Group at Apple to try to help figure out what's the next thing beyond personal computers. Megan Smith. Mark was very tied into Nicholas Negroponte and is part of that whole MIT Media Lab conversation. Andy Hertzfeld. Mark started by interviewing everyone at Apple, trying to come up with a consensus. What's in the wind? Eventually he decided the next thing beyond the personal computer combined two things. One is communication. The other thing is instead of being on the desk, it was in your pocket. Megan Smith. And Mark came up with this idea that he called a personal intelligent communicator. A smartphone, basically. The whole idea was there. Mark Porat. Remember something called the Sharp Wizard? It was a screen with some chiclet keys, one of those silly little organizer things, but useful. I took that and a Motorola analog cell phone, and I duct taped them together. That was the concept. Imagine this screen was beautiful. Imagine the applications were amazing. Imagine that it was linked wirelessly with you everywhere. And that little concept went around. And then we reduced it to something that was smaller and more beautiful. Andy Hertzfeld. And the smartest thing he ever did to make his vision real was make little models out of plaster. Steve Proman. He was showing what looked like a little wallet, a block of plastic wrapped in leather. Mark Porat. Everything was going to become very small, and in your hand, and intimate and jewelry-like. You'd wear it all the time, and if there was a fire in your house, you'd think, family goes first, and then I grab my pocket crystal. Megan Smith. Pocket crystal. That was his nickname for it. Andy Hertzfeld. The first thing I said when I saw his models was, well, they're not realistic. And he said, I know, but they will be. Michael Stern. Mark Porad was an incredible visionary. His pocket crystal project at Apple was really a previsioning of everything that we now take for granted. Mark Porad. I wrote a book on it, all the things that this thing is supposed to do and why this computing communication object would change the world. Michael Stern. Devices in your pocket, social networking, social media, a notion of an electronic community, anytime, anywhere communication, handheld devices that could enable you to do just about anything from shopping to research to talking to your mother. It's all there in that book he wrote. He was at Apple to help springboard the project and get it funded. Al Alcorn. So Mark was pushing this thing, and he infected Bill Atkinson and some of the other guys with this idea. Andy Hertzfeld. Mark met with Bill Atkinson, who had just finished HyperCard and was kind of looking around for what to do next, and he got Bill really excited about it. So one day, right after my friend Burrell Smith went insane, and I was dealing with that emotionally shattering experience and all of the fallout there, I get a phone call from Bill, incredibly excited. You've got to see this new thing at Apple. It's the next thing. And my first thought was, oh my God, Bill went insane too? But he didn't. And I called Bill and he said, you've got to meet with this guy, Mark. And so Mark called me up and I said, yeah, this is pretty interesting, but I don't want to work at Apple again. And Mark said, I understand you don't want to work there. Why don't we just pay you to be a consultant? And, you know, just get started. Mark Porat. Bill loved it. Andy saw it, was impressed that Bill was there. Bill was impressed that Andy was there. They immediately started seeing how to do it, and they signed up. Andy Hertzfeld. Bill created a prototype user interface in HyperCard. I wrote a server that allowed you to send little electronic graphical messages. Michael Stern. There were these beautiful little telecards with animations and handwritten notations and sound embedded in them. Andy Hertzfeld. All kinds of whimsical, wacky animations like we had a walking lemon, as well as these little graphical decorations also had meanings associated with them. Some of them you could even interact with, like one that was lips with a speech bubble. When you tapped on it, a microphone appeared. And you could talk into it and it would send your voice as part of the telecard. Michael Stern. These beautiful little things you could exchange with each other. That was Bill's thing. Andy Hertzfeld. We had what are now called stickers, which is part of instant messaging. You know how you could use little stickers in your messages? We had that working 20-some years before the iPhone, in a better way than most people have it now. Steve Jarrett. You've got to remember this was before even digital cellular existed. Mark Porat. Many of us had analog cell phones, which were bricks, and some of us carried batteries in a little tiny briefcase to go with the brick. Steve Jarrett. People were just using mobile phones to talk, so it's very, very early. Mark Porat. The theory and the strategy right from the beginning was to create a global standard. Apple and Microsoft would have the personal computer, IBM and Digital would have the bigger hardware, and we would do everything else. We would do telephones, we would do television set-top boxes, we would do kiosks, we would do absolutely everything else that had an operating system. Al Alcorn. But it clearly wasn't going to get supported by management at Apple. It wasn't going to happen. Mark Porat. It would need a lot of communication networking, including wireless, and it would need something that did not exist, which was a network to run on, which Apple did not have. Andy Hertzfeld. One company can make a computer, but it couldn't make a communicator all by itself. Because it wouldn't be able to establish the communication standards. So it couldn't be an Apple product. Mark Porat. But it was also clear that politically it was going to be okay to spin this thing out. John Gianandrea. I think a big part of spinning General Magic out of Apple was this idea that it was too big even for Apple, right? Apple couldn't deal with this thing. Mark Porat. So there were two projects established. General Magic on the outside and Newton on the inside. Andy Hertzfeld. The Newton project was an 8.5x11 tablet that was supposed to cost $5,000. Mark Porat. The Newton was a hedge in a big strategy that we had described to Scully. Andy Hertzfeld. Basically, Mark convinced John Scully
to not only let us spin out from Apple, but also to help us convince Sony and Motorola that they should join Apple in trying to create this new standard.
We called it the Alliance. Mark Porat. Apple, Motorola, Sony. So now we had the three board members as licensees, who were the core of the founding partners. Michael Stern. This is before the web. This is 1990, 1991. And so after we'd already formed a company and spun out of Apple, Andy Hertzfeld, we decided to bring AT&T into the fold. AT&T became the fourth investor in General Magic, on par with Sony, Motorola, and Apple. And that kind of worked. I was surprised. We were off and running. John Gianandrea. It was a ridiculously ambitious company. Mark Porat. People of enormous quality began to come over and see what this crazy team in downtown Palo Alto was doing and joined. Andy Hertzfeld. We had a lot of the original Mac people. Steve Perlman. It was a great group of people. To have a chance to work side by side with Andy and Bill? Come on. They're the real deal. These guys are just geniuses. I didn't care if they called it General Pickle. I was going to work side by side with Andy Hertzfeld and Bill Atkinson. What else could anyone ever dream for, right? I think I was employee number 13. Michael Stern. Andy and Bill were the gods of the universe. And then these kids came to work for them. Andy in particular was the mentor for and helped train a cohort of brilliant kids, many of whom had their first job at Magic, like Tony Fidel. Tony hung around and would just talk to people until we finally hired him. Tony Fidel. I had my own startup in Michigan doing educational software and getting frustrated being a big fish in a little pond.
There was no internet then.
So I would religiously read Mac Week and Mac World, and there was always the last page of each of those rags, which were like the murmurs, the rumors, the goings-on, and this company called General Magic kept popping up in it. I was like, whatever that is, I've got to learn more about it. Mark Porat. General Magic had all the buzz. All the buzz. It was where the pixie dust was. It was where you wanted to work if you were cool and smart. Tony Fidel. I am looking all over for General Magic, and I find out that their office is in Mountain View in this high-rise. And so I show up about 8:30 in the morning with a tie and a jacket on with my resume in hand and walk in the door. There was no one around. Or at least, I did not think so. So I walked down the hall, and I saw a couple people who looked like they'd been there all night. I was like, hey, I wanted to bring my resume by, wanted to see if you guys were hiring. They looked up at me with these bloodshot eyes like, leave us alone, kid. Michael Stern. But Tony just keeps pestering people until they hire him. Tony Fidel. I was humbled in the first 10 minutes of being there. I was like, oh my God, this is not like Michigan. These are the smartest people ever. I have got to be working here. Whereas Apple was still making computers, these people were making the next form of a Mac. It was the iPhone. 14 years too soon. It had a touch screen, it had an LCD, it was not pocketable, but it was portable. The size of a book. It had email, it had downloadable apps, it had shopping, it had animations and graphics and games. It had telecommunications, a phone, a built-in modem. I was like, I want to go with them, where they are making this stuff from scratch. I can be part of it. Mark Porat. He just walked in the door and impressed Bill and Andy and got his first gig to do stuff. General Magic was Broadway, and Andy and Bill gave this kid from the Midwest somewhere a break. Tony Fidel. Ultimately, they gave me the job, and I was the lowest guy on the totem pole. I came in, and I was working with my heroes. Michael Stern. We had a building right on the Mountain View Palo Alto border. That building had been empty for 10 years, and it had a pack of feral dogs living in the basement. So we were the first tenant. We had the top floor. It was a jungle. I mean, they had built like a model railroad that ran up the top of the building. Tony Fidel. That was not a train set. That was a remote-controlled car track. But I had a Lego train set in my cube and put that up and a bunch of other toys in my cube. Michael Stern. We had Bowser the pet rabbit, which lived there and would shit everywhere. Steve Perlman. Bowser was never trained to use kitty litter, so he would leave little gifts around the office. I typically walk around barefooted, and I would collect these little gifts between my toes. But Bowser was so cute and adorable, we all loved him. Michael Stern. People brought their dogs, and the parrot flew around, and the trains rattled around, and everybody lived there, kind of 24/7. John Gianandrea. Zarko Draganic famously slept under his desk for months at a time. Zarko shared a cube with Andy Rubin. Megan Smith. You'd say, "Hey, Zarko, let's meet at 3 o'clock," and then he would say, "A.M. or P.M.?" Michael Stern. The kids, they just worked nonstop. They'd work in bouts. Megan Smith. That's what the kids in Silicon Valley do in their 20s. We work like crazy and have an amazing time. Maybe some other folks are busy partying or doing whatever they're doing, but the Silicon Valley kids are inventing together. And that's the community. John Gianandrea. It was fun times. The place was kind of crazy, too. Mark Porat. The culture and the environment was Apple done even more fun. We had meals, we had spontaneous music things going on, we had Bowser running around, we had gunfights. Tony was the chief antagonist or protagonist with water weapons. He would start battles with water guns and pistols, and it was really fun. Steve Perlman. So much fun, but too much fun. Tony Fidel. Remember Gak? Or slime, the green slime? We would leave it on stuff, and we had all kinds of practical jokes on each other. Amy Lindberg. I hid a hot dog in Tony's computer, and he retaliated by putting a pickle inside my computer, and it shorted out a whole bunch of stuff. There was just always some little joke going on. It was just, we spent all of our time there. Every night was late night. Tony Fidel. We were known to work really late, 11 or 12, even 4 in the morning. It just depended. So this was about 10 or 11 o'clock at night, and we were all getting punchy. We were like, let's get out the Gak and the slingshot. Steve Jarrett. Somebody late one night had built a funnelator. It's like a slingshot. It was surgical tubing that could shoot anything. And so Tony and a bunch of other guys decided that they would put a bunch of this gel inside of the funnelator. Steve Perlman. People were having a meeting in an upper-story conference room, and we thought it would be really funny if we went and shot Gak so it splattered on the outside window. We'd watch it drool down. Tony Fidel. So who was it? I think Perlman and Andy were holding it on either end, and because earlier in the day we had lined it up, I was like, I am really going to pull this thing back. Steve Jarrett. Tony's really strong. Tony Fidel. Everyone is cheering me on. Go, go, Tony! So I am pulling it back, and they're like, go! And I'm like laying down on this thing, and the thing goes whoosh, and then pop! John Gianandrea. The green slime went straight at the window, and then the window just shattered. Fell out of the building, and we were like, whoops. Tony Fidel. I just looked, and my whole life flashed before my eyes. I am like, oh, fuck, I am going to get fired. What am I going to do? and we have an all-hands meeting the next morning. So I go and I sneak in the back just as it was starting.
And then, of course, everyone knows what I did. All of a sudden, everyone is just like, there's Tony!
And they just start clapping, and they're laughing and cheering, and I'm like, I broke a $6,000 window, and everyone is laughing and cheering? Mark Porat, I said all was forgiven. Do not even worry about it. There were no rules about having fun. There were other sorts of breakthroughs as well, technological ones. Steve Jarrett, so Tony and I were two of the youngest employees, and visibly so. At the time, we were probably, I don't know, I think we were maybe 23 and 24. We have a trip to Japan, which, because I'm the Japanese business development guy, I helped organize. We go to see all our partners there, and we're going to describe the design of the new hardware, the new chips, and the entire layout of the next generation of the hardware that we're creating. Tony Fidel. Japan was it for electronics in the early 90s. Even Apple could not make small stuff back then. And Mitsubishi Electric was a partner of General Magic's. Our job was to work with them on building new chips for our devices. So we presented the architecture for the next generation General Magic device, showing it off. Steve Jarrett. We go into this meeting, and Tony gets up and on the overhead projector puts down a slide. And he starts to walk through the diagram. Tony Fidel. I'm going through the block diagram, explaining it, and they were all, oh, yes, that is great, wonderful. Steve Jarrett. And so Tony gets to the part where he's describing the modem. He says, well, then, here's where you can connect the telephone cable. Tony Fidel. And they go, but, Tony-san, where is the modem? Michael Stern. In the block diagram, there was no modem chip. Tony Fidel. I said, in software. Steve Jarrett. They all look at each other, and one of them says, Hanto desu ka, which is, can it be true? The other guy just kind of shrugs his shoulders. Then they immediately just start yelling at each other in Japanese. One of them jumps up and grabs the telephone that's in the room and yells down the phone. They ask us to stop and wait. Tony Fidel. Just then the boss, Nagasawa-san, comes into the room and sees this activity. And as this happens, the loudspeaker goes, beep, beep, beep. And we are like, what is that? And somebody says, oh, there is a typhoon warning. We all need to leave before noon because we need to get home because the typhoon is coming. I go, really? And they go, yeah, but we are going to keep working. Steve Jarrett. 5 minutes later, guys in all these multicolor factory jumpsuits show up and fill the room. And then they say, Tony, again, please. Please describe your architecture. So Tony gets to the part and he says, well, this is where there's no modem because we've done it entirely in software. The one guy grabs his head in his hand and just hits his head on the table. I said, is everything okay? The guy who organized the meeting says, you have just obsoleted Kato-san's division. Tony Fidel. So while the whole of Mitsubishi Electric is being evacuated, the CEO and that team and us stay there the whole afternoon, and we sat in this room. And I think even at some point the power went out and we just kept talking. How do you do this modem and software? How do you do this device? They were blown away by the system on a chip, low voltage, all-in-one design, and the software modem. The CEO had never seen anything like it. Michael Stern. They were selling hundreds of millions of dollars in modem chips, and we made it so you don't need a chip anymore. So that was the kind of stuff that Magic accomplished. Again, Magic's DNA was Apple. We were Apple all the way. I mean, here is a little startup with limited working capital, and we are designing our own chips instead of going and buying them? Absolutely insane. Amy Lindberg. The OS, the hardware, the soft modem, all those achievements were amazing at the time. It was like the Apollo project. Steve Jarrett. The user interface was really visionary, too. It was groundbreaking. It was based on the real world. Tony Fidel. Each thing was a mock-up of the real world, and you would interact with those things like you would interact with the real world. Steve Jarrett, you started at a picture of a desk, and you could drag things around on the desk, and you tap on things to open them. Tony Fidel, it was skeuomorphic, like file cabinets to put your things in, a desk to write on. Steve Jarrett, and then you could leave the desk and go into the hallway, and in the hallway there'd be doors. Michael Stern, you'd click, and behind the doors were various rooms, like the game room, the media room, the library. In the library, there would be all your books, all of your electronic books, and we'd written some manuals, so there'd be something to populate the library. And in the game room, we had the first networked games. You could play online with opponents. No one had ever done it before. Again, this was something Tony just kind of whipped out in a day. Tony Fidel. And you would go out the door, and you could go down the street and go to a shop, which would be a virtual shop. Michael Stern. This is where the third-party developer community was connected. Because, remember, it was all about being a platform, not a closed system, so that third-party developers could develop applications. Productivity applications, games, you name it. They had them. We actually had wonderful games in the game room. Megan Smith. Pierre Omidyar was running all the developer services stuff. Steve Jarrett. Pierre was doing really early, really interesting work of thinking up online services that would work on these mobile devices that we were creating. He created a turn-based chess game that was easily the most popular game on our platform. Tony Fidel. It was pretty neat, you know? Michael Stern. So we were demonstrating all this stuff. Meanwhile, Mark is talking up the vision of the global community enabled by anytime, anywhere communications. So by 1992, we had all the ideas, and we were trying to build the thing. That was really hard, and we kept slipping. The schedule kept slipping, and the partners kept getting more and more anxious. Andy Hertzfeld. At the same time, we found out that our leading benefactor, our father, decided to kill us. Mark Porat. I remember a board meeting where we were laying out all the secrets and all the plans. In that meeting, John Scully was taking copious notes, word for word almost, just huge amounts of what was being said. And Andy turned to me and said, "What's up?" Andy Hertzfeld. The Newton Project had run aground. It wasn't going to work, and it was going to cost $10,000 instead of $5,000. You couldn't get the display, and it was too complicated, and it was failing. And with the Dynabook version of the Newton failing, he decided that Newton should instead copy Mark's vision and make something based on Mark's prototype. It should fit in your pocket at a low price point. Mark Porat. That was really a problem. Why did Apple not just put all their weight behind magic? Why did they have to hedge their bets? Scully set up the competition for essentially the same IP and the same market space. Andy Hertzfeld. The Newton was supposed to cost $5,000. They remade it to cost $500. It was supposed to be the size of a notebook, and it became the size of a postcard. Obviously, it was an existential threat. Mark Porat. The design center of the Newton was handwriting recognition. Our design center was personal communication. Personally, I thought there should have been enough blue sky between them so they could coexist, but it was widely viewed by both the teams and by outsiders, for example our licensees and the media, that they were set up to compete with each other. That was the perception. And there was some bitterness about that. Andy Hertzfeld. Scully was on our board. It was a real betrayal. The Newton debuted in August 1993, and it flopped. The main problem was the handwriting recognition software. It was not very good. But the fact that Gary Trudeau made the Newton into a recurring punchline in his nationally syndicated comic strip, Doonesbury, didn't help much either. Mike Doonesbury. I am writing a test sentence. Apple Newton. Siam fighting atomic sentry. Mike Doonesbury. I am writing a test sentence. Apple Newton. Ian is writing a taste sensation. Mike Doonesbury. I am writing a test sentence. Apple Newton. I am writing a test sentence. Mike Doonesbury. Catching on? Apple Newton. Egg freckles? Apple had rushed to market and paid the price. General Magic, meanwhile, wasn't going to make the same mistake that Scully did. Instead, they made the opposite mistake. Pursuing perfection, Magic fell several years behind. Mark Porat. AT&T was late. They could not get their network done. Sony was late. They could not get the consumer electronics piece done. We were late because we were perfectionists. We were late because we pushed ourselves to the limit. We felt a lot of pressure internally because we were late, and we had to synchronize our releases with how ready our partners would be. Everyone was late. 2 years late. Michael Stern. We missed Christmas of 94, so we really thought, okay, next year. Amy Lindberg. The first thing that we shipped was the Sony Magic Link. Andy Hertzfeld. And as soon as the Magic Link came out, I gave one to Steve. Mark Porat. Because it was inspired by the same kinds of things that the Mac OS was inspired by, it was built by the same people. It was designed by the same graphic artist. Michael Stern. And then as soon as we shipped, we went on the roadshow for the public offering. Mark Porat. I spent 80% of my energy managing the founding partners. We needed to be clear of them, and an IPO would get us enough money where we did not actually have to be so beholden to them. The IPO hinged on getting everything organized, and of course AT&T was the last one in to deliver what they needed to deliver, and then we were off to the races. Steve Jarrett. We'd already sold a significant amount of stock to these large partner companies, and we had a bunch of licensing revenue coming in, so the company looked super strong on paper. And so when we went public in 1995, it was one of the first internet IPOs in the sense that we had a particular price, and then we opened way, way above the S1 price. Mark Porat. We were priced at $14. Opened at $32, and took in tons of money. So the IPO as an event was very successful. But then the Magic Link sales were not good, and we said to ourselves, oh man, this is not going to go well. Andy Hertzfeld. We were hoping to sell 100,000 of the first Sony devices, but they only sold like 15,000. Steve Jarrett. The hardware was too large. The battery life wasn't great. They were very expensive. The first Sonys were $1,000. Remember, these weren't mobile phones. These were devices that, to communicate, you had to plug in a telephone cable. Megan Smith. The devices were doing so many new things that nobody knew what we were talking about. Why would they want something like this? Amy Lindberg. We were designing a product for Joe Sixpack. Literally, they would call the customer Joe Sixpack. And the trouble is that at that time, Joe Sixpack didn't have email. It was too early. John Gianandrea. One of the great Silicon Valley failure modes is right idea way too early. Amy Lindberg. And then the internet started to emerge. Mark Porat. One day, as I recall, someone brought in something called Mosaic, and they said, this is the future. I said, okay, what is it? We loaded it up, and it crashed immediately. Well, why is this the future? Just watch, he put it back up. Gianandrea. We downloaded this thing, and people were crowded around the workstation. I think it was a Silicon Graphics Indigo, and we were like, look at that. Mark Porat. We were looking at a really early browser, and there was already awareness inside the team that we had to go internet. We knew that release 2.0 would have to be an internet machine. The question was, can we ship the first one, and still have enough time, money, energy, and stamina to get to the second one. Michael Stern. We have no revenue. Things aren't working. The partners start bailing. Things are getting pretty ugly. Steve Jarrett. We kept taking the first generation hardware to trade shows and kept getting asked, oh, does it have a phone inside of it? It became really clear that the next product that we should try to build should actually be a cellular phone. And so Andy and the other engineers started to make a smartphone, a handheld cellular phone that was running our software. Again, remember, like, this is before digital cellular existed, so SMS didn't exist, and you couldn't send data over cellular. And so they built this very early prototype, which had wireless web browsing. John Gianandrea. So there were two devices. There was the device being built for Sony, and everybody knew that it was a dog. I was working on the second product, which was going to be cheaper, faster, have better battery life. Mark Porat. Andy and Bill demoed a magic machine, which was in a format like an iPhone, and they said, so this is what we are going to ship next. It is a phone, and you can see all the Magic Link icons on it. And let me show you how it works. They go through the contact manager, the telephone, sending emails, the works. That was iPhone form factor, and that was iOS functionality in 1995. We were very excited about it, and they said that this is the next thing that we are going to do. That was for 1997. Steve Jarrett. But was this actually physically possible for us to do? It was clear that was going to take years to build a super compelling product like that. For me, that was the sign. That's when I left the company. John Gianandrea. I quit. Part of it was realizing that we had a better product and we weren't going to ship it. Mark Porat. We were 1 year away from it. We kind of ran out of gas. We ran out of steam and ran out of the will to take the next step. Most of us were exhausted, for our own reasons. Andy had probably worked 80 hours a week forever. We were just plain tired. Michael Stern. After his first big surge of creativity, Bill kind of checked out. Andy was running engineering for 3 years. He had just had enough by 95. Mark Porat. It was a physical fatigue when you keep something alive for 5 years on a vision and on just the raw energy of passion to do something amazing. 5 years is a long time to keep that going, and you want some validation at the end of it. Michael Stern. So everybody leaves. I stayed on because I felt some loyalty to Mark. It was really sad and ugly. Everyone who touched the project at their respective companies, at Motorola, at Sony, and AT&T, their careers were wrecked. Because these companies had gone public saying, we're doing the next big thing, we're creating the future here. And then it crashed. It was a train wreck. Mark Porat. Engineers do things because they want millions of people to touch it. That is the ultimate reward for a top-level engineer. And when millions of people do not touch it, where is your source? Where is your juice? Where is the passion coming from? Where does the juice come from to take it to the next level? You need some affirmation. Companies need some affirmation to keep going. Michael Stern. The company failed. We didn't ship a product that people wanted to buy. But this cadre of brilliant kids in this incredible pressure cooker went on to do amazing things and create the world that we now take for granted. Megan Smith. There was this group at Apple that apprenticed with Steve Jobs, Woz, Mike Markula, and all that crew, and learned. And then at General Magic, they became the Wizards. And then we're the apprentices. Phil Goldman and Zarco and Tony, Amy. We were the junior group to this senior group. Amy Lindberg. Tony went on to do the iPod and the iPhone. Steve Perlman. Phil Goldman and Bruce Leak both founded Web TV with me. Andy Rubin joined later. Amy Lindberg. And then Andy went on to do Android. And Zarco spun out the software modem. which was the first modem ever in software in the world. Michael Stern. Megan left Magic and went to San Francisco and founded Planet Out, the first online community for lesbians. It became very successful, and of course she ended up as the CTO of the United States of America. Not bad. Amy Lindberg. General Magic was the kind of company where a guy who's going to be a billionaire in a couple of years didn't even raid a window cube. Chris McCaskill. Pierre Omidyar was running AuctionWeb on his Mac 2 CI in his cubicle. Pete Helmy. Supposedly the idea came at a local Chinese restaurant while he and a bunch of General Magic guys were talking. You know, wouldn't it be great to sell stuff on the internet? And what about an auction format? Michael Stern. So Pierre came to me when I was the general counsel in 1994 and said, I've created this little electronic community. I'm getting people to talk to each other about trading tchotchkes. We're creating traffic on the network and getting people into a community. That's kind of in our sweet spot, isn't it? That was General Magic's thing, the whole notion of electronic community. I said, that's the stupidest idea I've ever heard. If you want to do it, bye. See you later. That was eBay. Amy Lindberg. Everything came out of General Magic like just a big explosion. Michael Stern. iPhones, social media, electronic commerce, it all came out of Magic. That's the story. The Bengali Typhoon. Wired's Revolution of the Month. By the early 90s, Silicon Valley had racked up an impressive array of fascinating failures. The Well never scaled up. VR never took off. General Magic was in the process of imploding. The Valley's breakthroughs were not breaking through. Meanwhile, up in Washington State, Microsoft was having great success in incrementally leveraging its humdrum operating system into de facto control of the personal computer industry. The money and power were shifting decisively north. Yet the Valley was still the center of an emerging nerd culture, and that culture had a powerful new tool. The Mac 2, when loaded up with desktop publishing software and paired with a laser printer, was a new kind of printing press. It allowed small, tech-savvy editorial teams to create magazines that looked like they were produced by publishing empires. Suddenly, the bohemian world of West Coast publishing, of which the Whole Earth catalog was the prime example, had an opportunity to disrupt the real publishing world. San Francisco's techno underground launched a raft of new titles, including Future Sex, Mondo 2000, and most importantly, Wired. John Plunkett. Where did Wired come from? You have to go back to Nicholas Negroponte and his insight that led to the creation of the Media Lab. Nicholas Negroponte. The original idea for the Media Lab was very simple. We foresaw a coming together of three industries which were previously completely distinct. You would pull the audiovisual richness out of the broadcast entertainment ring. You would pull the depth of knowledge and information out of the publishing ring. And you would take the intrinsic interactivity of computers and put these three things together to get the sensory, rich, deep interactive systems that today we call multimedia. John Plunkett. Stuart Brand wrote a book, The Media Lab, Inventing the Future at MIT, which Lewis and I read. It was a big factor in Lewis's realization that, hey, there could be a magazine about this. Lewis Rossetto. So, previous to Wired, we were in Amsterdam and we produced a magazine called Language Technology, which became Electric Word. We changed the name in the middle of its life. Jane Metcalf. We sent a copy to Kevin Kelly. Lewis Rossetto. We had a piece on Anthony Burgess about how word processing affects writing, and a piece on Nicholson Baker, who was a word worker, a novelist. This is like the seed for everything that came out ultimately in Wired. Kevin Kelly. And I thought, Wow, this is interesting. So I reviewed it for Whole Earth. I called it the least boring computer magazine there was. Louis Rossetto. He had written this gracious thing, and so we said, we want to go meet Kevin Kelly. And so we went to visit him in his chaotic office. He had billions of books all over the place. Jane Metcalf. Stacks and stacks and stacks of books everywhere. Kevin Kelly. I was interested in the culture of technology. I felt that there was something big moving there, and I was interested in trying to move Whole Earth in that direction. My thing at Whole Earth was I did the special issues, and I did this special issue called Signal in 1988 as a kind of a trial, because to me the hippie colors of Whole Earth were beginning to wear a little thin. This was the same territory as Wired would be, but it was mostly about ideas and concepts. There was not a lot of profiles or stuff like that. Louis Rossetto. We had an incredible high bandwidth conversation. We really enjoyed each other for the hour, hour and a half that we met. Kevin Kelly. All I could say was, well, if you're going to do the magazine like this, you can't possibly do it in Amsterdam. You have to do it in San Francisco. That's all I could say. That and get on the well. Louis Rossetto. Then we went back to Amsterdam. We tried to keep Electric Word going, and we couldn't do that. Then we came up with the Wired idea, and we came to California. Kevin Kelly. 2 years later, maybe, they reappeared with the news that they were moving to San Francisco, and they were going to start the magazine that they were trying to do in Amsterdam, but couldn't. My thought was, good luck. Starting a magazine is an assignment for dreamers. Louis Rossetto. There was a lot of trying to meet people who ended up becoming subjects of what we were doing. Bruce Sterling. They called me up and said, hi, we're publishers, and we'd like to show up on your doorstep because we hear you're a science fiction writer, and we need more science fiction writers to be reporters for our new magazine. I'm like, yeah, come by the spread. They were on their way to San Francisco to start the magazine. They were kitted out in full Amsterdam Euro techno. Jane was wearing some very handsome shoes, the kind you would never see on a tech chick. I assumed that they were complete cranks. They didn't look like any of the Mondo 2000 cyber hippies I was hanging out with at the time. Are you serious? Mondo 2000 was really the first technoculture magazine, starting in 1989. Previous to that, computer magazines were sort of like car magazines. They were entirely designed and oriented toward the mechanics of it, if you will. Mondo 2000 took technology and treated it as an element of counterculture. Fred Davis. I had been working for Ziff Davis as editor of A+, PC Magazine, PC Week, Mac User. Louis and Jane showed up at my house in Berkeley, literally broke, with nothing but this idea to do Wired as a high-end version of Mondo 2000. Mark Pauline. The Mondo 2000 people were like, well, we'll see about that. Dan Kotke. Before it was Mondo, it was called High Frontiers, and then it changed to Reality Hackers. It was a mixture of technology and culture and literature and music and film, with drugs and consciousness studies. Are you serious? So it was this merger of the psychedelic influences, technological influences, and strange ideas that were going around in the area of science and pseudoscience, and quantum physics and pop culture. Fred Davis. Wired was closer to what I would consider potential to be a mainstream mag. Jane Metcalf. Before we launched, we had a private conference on the well, where potential contributors...
Anybody who was a friend or whatever could come and comment or participate.
Fred Davis. Lewis had a good concept, but to raise money, they needed a good story about the audience. I helped put that together. Louis Rossetto. But it became apparent that we still needed something else to sell it. So we said, let's bear down and create something that looks like a real magazine, a real prototype, that shows the edit and advertising, the attitude that the magazine was supposed to represent. We began to gather editorial material, advertising, and put the thing together as best we could, and then got together with Eugene.
Eugene Mosier. I had no idea what I was getting myself into.
Jane Metcalf. We were in the building right on the corner of 2nd and South Park. Jack Boulware. It was this building at the end of an alley in a pretty funky neighborhood where we were doing our satirical magazine, The Nose. Then Future Sex moved there. Dave Eggers was doing Cups, which was a coffee shop magazine. Then he launched Might magazine, but they all had an office in the same building. Coco Jones. It was an open post-industrial space that a lot of magazines shared. I was working for Mondo at the time. To my left were Jane and Louis. Louis Rossetto. It was a really sketchy neighborhood. We got there around mid-June, and within 2 weeks, somebody put a bullet through the front window, a big plate glass window in the front, and it landed behind Jane's desk. Jane Metcalf. And then on the 4th of July, somebody shot a bullet through the front door of the place. Louis Rossetto. Two incidents, two bullets. Eugene Mosier. They said, we don't have a computer. I said, that's okay. They were borrowing office space near where I lived. It was a matter of walking to the office with my stuff. I put my Mac 2CI and Apple LaserWriter 2 on a cart and rolled them down the street. Louis Rossetto. Eugene brought his computer, got another computer and another screen for me to work on while Jane got a hard drive, an incredible gift from the universe to help us finish. For the last 2 weeks, Eugene called in sick to his day job and then worked to produce the prototype and then helped us actually print it. Jan Metcalf. He'd worked for MacWeek when they converted to desktop publishing and just didn't want to work for the man or whatever. Fred Davis. Desktop publishing was the killer app for the Macintosh. It fueled an explosion of people buying Macintoshes just to have the LaserWriter, which cost $6,000, by the way. That is the most anyone in the personal computer industry had ever charged for a printer. People bitched about the price, but the Apple LaserWriter could do real typography and allow you to create camera-ready copy from a device that cost a tiny fraction of what a big printing press cost. This was a whole new thing in publishing. It was a whole new underground culture, which was the Mac culture. Eric Davis. The counterculture of the 60s and 70s had split into a wide variety of subcultures, and one manifestation of this was the explosion of zines, which were a pre-web, pre-listserv way for small communities of obsessives to get together. The 80s really was the decade for zine culture, and pretty soon people realized that by bringing in these new technologies, you could sort of make a whole cultural space that was partly fantasized, and then almost instantly became partly real. Because when you have the publishing tools that let you be slick, you can make your own pop universe. You can make something that feels pop because it looks pop. And then you draw people to it, and it becomes pop. So it was kind of like a subcultural hack that just did very, very well. Jack Boulware. I don't remember anybody ever buying a copy of any of the software, never. It was a sign of weakness if you bought software. People were trading floppy disks all the time. You would just ask somebody, oh, I'll make you a disk. Jane Metcalf. Eugene was a whiz at figuring out digital production issues. Eugene Mosier. The challenge, early in the desktop publishing days, was how to get the stuff out of the computers and onto paper so it could be shown to someone. The first PostScript interfaces for color copiers were just coming out. We found this copy shop in Berkeley that had one. Jane convinced them that it would be good publicity if we ran out the dummy of our mag on their machine. So we brought our files and started printing. We quickly realized it was taking way longer to reproduce a page than we had imagined. It was going to be an afternoon. That stretched into evening and then became obvious it would run overnight. The people at the copy shop gave us the keys and went home. We proceeded to spend the entire weekend pressing the print button and taking catnaps. We managed to print an entire magazine over the course of 3 days. Jane Metcalf. Oh, we did not sleep. And of course they opened up the next morning, and people started coming in, so we had to go over to a little